Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. My name is Darius Vasefi, producer and host, and this interview is being recorded on Clubhouse and will be published on retailtechpodcast.com in a few days. Today, I am speaking with Brian Kroll, VP of a company called AdTaxi, and they are an advertising agency. So we're going to be talking about some really important topics, including the iOS 14.5 privacy changes and then the impact on e-commerce and just in general what Brian is seeing change since last year. How are you today, Brian?
I'm doing great, Darius. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for joining me.
So, yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's start by talking about maybe a little bit about your background, how you got to, I guess, be here at the AdTaxi, and then what AdTaxi does, and then we'll get into the other conversations.
Awesome. Yeah, well, so my background, I've been in paid media sales for, I've had many, many, I guess, like careers, but for most of my careers have been in paid media sales. Starting out in like print advertising way back in the day, and for the sake of knowledge here, I'm in my late 40s, so print was pretty big back when I was, you know, still pretty big back in the late 90s. I moved over to the digital side, and for the last 10 years or so, I've been with a company called AdTaxi, AdTaxi.com. We are a strategic paid media placement agency, where it's all digital, and we work with sort of all of the sort of main platforms. So we run, you know, paid search ads, paid social ads through Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and then we also do a whole lot of programmatic, primarily through the Trade Desk, which is our DSP of choice. And I'm the VP of strategic accounts. I'm involved in a lot of sort of sales, but also wear a lot of hats. So do a lot of sort of like background tech and product work on our company as well. So,
okay.
Hopefully, that was a good yeah. synopsis.
Yeah, that's a good primer. So, you know, we're going to get right into it. The question is, you know, the iOS 14.5 privacy changes, which have caused, you know, a lot of problems. And of course, it led to the public fight between Apple and Facebook. And so maybe if you can go through and just give us a background on that and maybe tell us some of the details of like what the actual changes were.
Yeah, you bet. So it all kind of started in June of 2020 at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. They announced the release of iOS 14, which is, you know, their operating system for all of their mobile platforms, basically for you know, anything that you're doing on your phone, tablet, et cetera, iPads. And one of the biggest changes that they announced was that iOS 14 was going to be all about privacy. And you probably have remembered seeing some of the commercials that they were putting out where they were investing this in, you know, traditional media, where, you know, the guy on a bus saying like, I search divorce attorneys 14 times today or whatever it would be. And they're just kind of trying to make fun of it, but get people to pay attention to basically like what is being tracked on your phone. And the whole concept was, you know, for them that it's all about privacy. And what they did was they had sort of a couple of different releases, and they ended up pushing things back because when they announced everything at the developer conference, the biggest change was going to be what they eventually got released in 14.5, which is something called app tracking transparency. And essentially what it does is it gives consumers a choice to basically through sort of like their sort of app sort of privacy labels to understand what apps are tracking about all of us when we're on our phones. But it gives people a choice to basically ask the app not to track. And it was something that was kind of running in the background. And in when they finally released 14.5, 5.1, actually, when they made this sort of mandatory, any app that was on in the Apple iStore was required to sort of launch this sort of like modal prompt that would say, you could kind of choose what you wanted to say on it as an app developer, but you know, essentially it was, do you want to allow this app to track you, yes or no? So allow tracking or don't allow tracking. And some apps did, I think, a good job of it. Twitter had something, you know, talking about like personalized ads, you know, do you want to keep personalized ads or do you want to see less relevant ads? There's, I thought was kind of cool. But basically that was the gist of it is, you know, do you want to allow all of this major tracking that's going on or do you not? And if consumers opted out of tracking, it had major ramifications for the data that could be collected and passed back to, you know, either ad platforms or to the developers themselves. And one of the main things that it was passing back was when, let's say I'm in an app and I click on an ad, most ad servers are going to have a couple of what's called like postbacks. So you would post back if somebody clicked on a link, it would go directly to, you know, obviously I would click out and go to the website for whatever the ad that was, you know, promoting, you know, pick an example. I click on an ad, I go to the website. When you would make that click, it would send an additional array of tons of different kinds of information about the click on that ad. And what Apple's app tracking transparency did was if somebody opted out of tracking, it limited severely the amount of information that could be passed back from that link click. And it also limited the amount of time in which that information could be held by the browser or the user agent. So on your iPhone, it's generally Safari. It used to be that Safari could hold it for as long as Safari wanted to, or as long as they could, sometimes as long as like 28 days is sort of like the standard. But it basically said you can't send anything. You have to wait at least 24 hours before sending it, and you have to send it both in 7 days, otherwise it's lost. So what this change had a massive impact, especially for Facebook, because so many people interact with Facebook through an app. Most of the Facebook interaction is through an app on your phone or on your tablet. Some people obviously still go into the browser sort of the old-fashioned way, but most of the time it's through an app. And these changes caused huge disruptions to Facebook in terms of what they could track and what they could not track, and what also you could report out on in terms of you know, advertising performance metrics if you were running ads on their platform. So it was sort of like a seismic shift in terms of what could be tracked and what couldn't. And it prompted Facebook to make a ton of changes in their platform to try and deal with it as the best they could once they kind of realized, I think, the scope of the meteor that was coming at them.
Okay. So to understand the changes a little bit better, one of the things that I read was that the apps could actually track which other apps or websites you went to on while that app was open. Is that accurate? I don't know. I don't know if I actually read that correctly or not. So maybe you can help with clarifying that for me.
Yeah. So yes. And so not to get like overly technical, but depending on the app, they definitely are tracking where you're going. And so, like, let's say that I'm on Facebook in the old days. Anything that I go on Facebook and I click on an ad or I click on a story or I click on anything, when I'm in the app, it's pulling up that browser user agent. So they know where I'm going, what I'm reading, and everything else. But because of the sort of pervasiveness of the Facebook pixel, It works, I think, largely as think of it as like a signal that can be picked up from just about anywhere there is another Facebook pixel, whether I'm in, you know, my own ad account or somebody else's ad account, whatever it may be. The Facebook pixel is sort of ubiquitous, and if they see a signal coming in from somebody where I'm showing up on this app or wherever, then you would know that if I'm on an advertiser's website, Facebook, you know, knows that, like, hey, or any website, not necessarily an advertiser. If I go to, you know, Bed Bath & Beyond or something like that, they've got a Facebook pixel there. Facebook knows who I am because I'm logging into the app. They recognize sort of my profile in my browser, and they know where I'm going at any time. So if they ask the app not to track on that device, it severely limits the sort of data that's passed back because they're not able to sort of say, like, you know, hey, well, this user ID or this device ID ended up going to multiple different sites or and could get an idea. And that's kind of how, like, broadly, like, they're able to infer, you know, not only, like, interest or intent, but also that's how, you know, it works from the standpoint of, like a remarketing or something. So, like, you know, if I'd been on a website and I was the advertiser, say I'm Bed Bath & Beyond as an advertiser, and I wanted to remarket somebody who was looking at something, then, you know, you were able to serve ads to those people sort of wherever they go across the open internet. And that this change dramatically, I think, impacted how remarketing could happen, whether it was on Facebook or off Facebook or anybody else with it was, you know, primarily dealing with in-app advertising. So it had a kind of a massive, massive impact there.
All right. So remarketing is the same as retargeting, right? Or is it different?
Correct.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
It's the same. Okay.
Yeah, that's how I was using it. Yes.
Okay. All right. So let's see. The other question that I had was that: is it correct that this ability was already present for users, but it was just hidden so far back that it was just hard for people to actually see it? And now, with the new change, it's right there, like when you actually open the app. Is that correct or not?
Yeah, so you did have the ability to sort of like opt out to a degree from what you wanted to see from Facebook or from anywhere. But it was, and you know, I'm not trying to just like pick on Facebook here, but they're probably one of the most impacted. I mean, Snapchat was impacted. Lots of other folks have been impacted by this as well. But it's, you know, there are ways that you could do this. And I think sort of Apple's main argument for doing this was they wanted to sort of bring everything to the forefront and give users control over their data. Now, this is, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, because I believe that, you know, being in this industry for a long time, the sort of value exchange between consumers and the content that they're reading or, you know, like what they're doing online, has never really been explained very well by the advertising industry, where it's sort of like, you know, hey, you can visit the site for free. You don't have to pay anything to go on to CNN.com or to, you know, ESPN or whatever. Obviously they've got subscription models and everything now too, but you don't have to pay anything to go there. And these websites are supported by ads. And coming from, you know, like the newspaper publishing side of things, local journalism, 100% supported by ads, especially those websites. So like this change, you know, it's had sort of like a major impact, because a lot of people don't necessarily want to see ads, but they don't want to give up the content. And so I think part of what this change is doing, which is interesting, is it's sort of letting people know that, you know, hey, this is how you're getting this content for free. Do you want to see ads? And only you're going to see ads anyway. Do you just want to see relevant ads, or do you want to see random ads that have absolutely no relevance to you whatsoever and are potentially going to damage your browser or user experience. So that's been really sort of like one of the more interesting, I think, impacts, I guess, of the change.
And that relevance is really a subjective thing. I mean, you can you like measure, prove to me as a user that what you're showing me is more relevant than what it was before?
It's hard. I think that like measuring relevance is generally on interactions. So, you know, like if you were to look at it and say like, okay, well, you know, Brian is on this website and he's clicking on these ads, these types of ads more than these other ads. You could try and get an idea of roughly like what I'm interested in or you know, not just on, you know, like first party data that a publisher might have, but also third party data. The entire data ecosystem is just incredibly vast. And you know, like it's the third party data, and this gets beyond just the whole iOS thing, but more along the lines of what Google's talking about with the deprecation of third party cookies in Chrome completely, you know, sometime, you know, next year, 2 years from now. I think they gave it a stay of execution to next year, 2 years from now at least. But it's you know, all of that data is used to inform decisions about which ads to show people, and it's leveraged in sort of the auction process, where you know, advertisers will pay more for what they believe is putting the exact right message in front of the exact right user at the right time using that data. And so the implications of losing some of those signals are that some publishers that rely heavily on that are probably going to lose money. They're still going to show ads, but they're just not going to get as much revenue from those ads. And also the advertisers, in theory, may not get as much benefit from those ads because I would be willing to pay a higher cost per thousand in terms of like a CPM for my bids if I was going to get a lower cost per acquisition. So it's something where it's, you know, just having it's for about 2 to 3 years, I would say that being a digital marketer, we were kind of in the golden era of having whatever data that you wanted, whatever you wanted to do with it. Now, right or wrong, that's kind of the way it was. We're kind of going back to the older sort of methods of how do we measure things now when you have some signal loss and you may not be able to measure everything you used to be able to measure, you know, with the incredible granularity you had because of some of this. But it's forced us back into, you know, doing better modeling and better forecasting outside of just kind of using the platforms, because the platforms have all just kind of been like a race to the bottom where they've set up smart bidding or they've set up, you know, auto optimization goals using all this data, and it was almost impossible to beat on your own without, you know, having direct access to the bidding system. So it's definitely sort of been like a very huge change in terms of how the industry, I think, is adopting to putting the right ads in front of people and measuring the impact and success of that, and then how do we make optimization choices from an advertising agency perspective to get the best possible value for our advertisers.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that the topic of relevance is probably a big one, and it could take a while to discuss. So now let's talk about, well, so something else you just mentioned is I've also heard this phrase, the death of the cookie. What's that all about?
Mm-hmm. So it's something that Apple already did this a while ago in Safari, but basically Safari sort of by default now blocks third-party cookies, which would be essentially like cookies from, so the difference between a first and a third-party cookie is if I go to a website, use a CNN example, CNN could drop a cookie down to know that like, okay, I've logged in, I've got a profile, I've maybe customized my experience to know like where, how I want to see my news, etc. That would be like a first-party cookie. A third-party cookie would be something where, let's say I was in market for, refinancing my home or something, and I went to a lending site, and I was playing around to sort of see, like, you know, what rates were out there. That lending site might sell that data to advertisers, and advertisers might say, like, okay, I'm a bank. I want to target people who are in market to refinance their home, and I want to target them sort of wherever they go across the web. That would be more like a third-party cookie if I was on CNN and now, you know, like whatever it would be, pick any bank that does mortgages, they are going to, you know, they would want to try and target me based on that sort of like third-party data, even though I'm on CNN's site. That would go away in the sense of, you know, how that would work from a cookie perspective, where they wouldn't have necessarily that amount of targeting, but it also really impacts the metrics for optimization, because the way that most ad platforms are tracking conversions is there's an advertising pixel or a cookie essentially from the ad platform that is basically hitchhiking along with all those ads, and that pixel would then also get blocked. So essentially what you have would be, instead of like a direct click coming through, so what you would sort of see in like Google Analytics or something, it essentially would wipe out to a large degree cookie-based profiling, cookie-based attribution, and that was that would be a big change. Now there's a lot of different sort of competing solutions that are out there to try and replace this. One of which is that the Trade Desk has been promoting, and that a lot of folks have sort of started signing onto, is their concept of like a unified ID, where they've kind of are developing a technology where it's not a cookie, but it's really something where like you sign on with some sort of unique identifier that is then hashed and salted so that it's not identifiable to me. So like, let's say I had my, you know, bkroll@adtaxi.com email address and I use that as my identifier when I signed on to read content or something like that. Nobody would be able to tell exactly like who I am other than the fact that it's like my unique identifier. And then that would be, that would sort of replace the cookie. And that's kind of how it works now with most of the emerging media, like connected TV or streaming audio, et cetera. Those don't have cookies by default. It's all based around sort of like some other type of identifier. Generally, it's like an email address. And so that's sort of like one of the ways that people are talking about replacing it. One of the other ways is Google had presented their own, which is sort of like a federated learning of cohorts, or FLOC for short. And their version was basically like, hey, we're going to aggregate 1,000 people, and we're going to make models and predictions off of the actions of those 1,000 people to sort of keep it privacy safe and privacy compliant. But it's really all about just, you know, how do we keep things as private as possible? But then also, I think in like the case of like the Unified ID 2.0, that gets back to the value exchange where, you know, I'm giving you a little bit of information, but it's not much. But in exchange, I get information and like free browsing, etc.
Okay. Yeah. So that's, I guess, was my... One of my next question was that what are the ad tech companies or advertising platforms doing to deal with these changes? And I think you mentioned a couple of them.
Those are some of the big ones. Some of the other things that Facebook is kind of doing as well too is they're setting up, or they already have, but like a conversions API where people who on websites, it's doing roughly the same thing, but it's transmitting hashed user data from, let's say I check out on an online site, it's hashed user data sent back to Facebook so that they can say that, you know, they don't, like, it's not transmissive that knows that, like, I made the purchase, but it's associated with Facebook profile, saying, like, hey, since this person made a purchase, and they're able to kind of track things that way too.
Okay. And I'm assuming that these are just getting like started, and there will probably be other changes in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's I think that's definitely very, very true. I think GDPR coming out in Europe, so the general data protections that Europe rolled out, or the EU rolled out, was sort of like the start of all of this. And then in California, where I live, we had CCPA, which passed a little while ago. There are other legislation just passed in Virginia. I think there's probably multiple different legislations that are passed that are basically like about consumers and how you have access to their data. So I think we are going to see more changes as the future unfolds. And I think just as an industry, it's just something that we're all going to have to kind of roll with the punches. The interesting thing about the Trade Desk solution is that they're not trying to own it or control it. They actually turned it over to a third party sort of independent governing body. And a lot of people are starting to sign on to that. They have, you know, partnership like LiveRamp's sort of thing signed on a little bit. And then some of the large holding companies on Madison Avenue are signed up for it too. So it's going to be interesting to kind of see how things move and evolve. But it's never a dull moment.
Definitely a dynamic situation. Yeah, I mean, I can tell you from a user's perspective myself, I hate this GDPR notices that come up on every freaking website every time I go there. It's just so annoying. I mean, this is supposed to, I hope they're working on coming up with a better way to do that, but it's just like, you know, it's adds work on the side of, on the part of the users. So I don't know. Anyway, yeah. So let's start talking about how companies are dealing with this and how agencies are actually changing some of their tactics and procedures, processes to adjust and adapt to these changes, and how those are impacting like e-commerce companies or retail companies that are acquiring customers online.
Yeah, so there's been a ton of change. And I mean, just kind of focus on the Facebook side, since they're one of the sort of behemoths of advertising, and for good reason. I mean, their ads have worked really well for a lot of marketers.
Now, just to clarify, by Facebook, you are combining Facebook and Instagram, or just
correct?
Facebook?
Yes. Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. So whatever you can buy through the Facebook ads, business manager, which is like their ads platform. So kind of wherever you can go with that. Yeah, it's had some pretty interesting ramifications. First off, when you went from, let's say you're a marketing manager and you were reporting up to a certain level of return on ad spend or a return on investment to your executive team or whatever, all of a sudden, Facebook made a sudden change where they eliminated a lot of the metrics. You used to be able to look back 28 days if you wanted to see, you know, how far back it would be for somebody to make a click and convert, which is arguably a long time, but that was sort of like the max window that they had, both for a click and a view. And suddenly they changed that, where now the maximum you could look back was 7 days, and that would be on a click and 1 day on a view. And if people opted out, then you didn't have the view whatsoever because of Apple's changes. And as much as I think a lot of marketers would love it if everything was 100% click-based and you could see everything going through a click, it's just not the way that consumers work on the internet a lot of times. I may see an ad and I may think about that ad and I'm like, hey, that actually is cool. I dig that process. But I was in the middle of doing something else, or I saw some news on, or I had to go cook dinner, who knows, whatever it'd be. When I go back onto Facebook or I go onto any other platform, the odds of that ad being there are probably slim to none unless I spend a lot of time looking for it. As a consumer, it's just easier to just say, like, okay, I saw that company, I'm just going to Google them and I'm going to convert, I buy, I'm done. So in the sense of, when we think about like attribution for marketing, prior to this change, if I did all of this on my Apple device, you'd be able to see that, you know, somebody was first exposed to an ad on Facebook and later converted on Google or something like that. But now it's sort of, there's a sort of a wall in the middle. And so Google Organic would get the credit and you're not going to see any results from your ad if I had opted out from Facebook tracking. So as a marketer, you're thinking, wow, that ad doesn't work, or that's not working as well as it used to, even though it actually did. So connecting the dots is sort of a big challenge there. One of the other big challenges from retail is going to be on the remarketing side of things, and also on the consumer side too. So I know, putting on my consumer hat and being in this business, if I ever purchased something and then I still saw ads and somebody was retargeting the thing I just purchased, I would always get frustrated and think, like, okay, you're kind of not, you should probably get a little bit better at what you're doing, because you should be suppressing that. I already purchased that. You're wasting your money sending me an ad, showing me an ad of something I just bought. But that is now going to be a lot harder to do because of the sort of missing data signals where consumers may be seeing things because we don't know that you didn't just already purchase it, where it would have been a complete one-to-one tie-off previously. Likewise, it might be something where from like a remarketing standpoint, I may be seeing ads or prospecting ads that are different, that are less relevant than what I was thinking, because there's just a loss of signal data there. So there's, I think, a lot of challenges where revenues may not necessarily have dropped off in terms of if you're using Google Analytics to measure your e-commerce revenue or store sales revenue, but the signal loss may not have had an immediate impact in terms of 30 days or so. But a lot of people, I think, have struggled a little bit in, now that the signal loss is more apparent and that more people, it also had to do with adoption rates. Not everybody immediately upgrades to the very first or the very latest version of a software for an app. And so when really 14.6 and 14.7 came out, those had more automatic updates. We started seeing, 50, 60, 70% of our advertisers' traffic was now from iOS traffic, was now on that version. And that's when things started to get a little bit more challenging. So as you had more potential for signal loss, it just makes it a little bit harder to make decisions. You're not as fully informed in terms of what you would do from an advertising marketing perspective. And so it changes things a little bit in terms of what just the overall effectiveness of how the ads can do from targeting. And a little bit more into the, let's not get, away a little bit from the precision, and has forced a lot of people to make changes to, how they sort of rethink their optimization and how they rethink how they're communicating results and success up to management, or how agencies are doing it to their clients. So it's definitely been a challenge, but it's not something that's insurmountable. There's still...
It's not going to stop the ad agencies or the ad business.
Ad business, correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay. If a So if I'm an e-commerce player or I'm a company, so is there a difference between e-commerce and, for example, like software as a service type businesses and how they're impacted or?
Yeah, people who are measuring app download campaigns, anybody who wants to try and get those types of things definitely impacted. I would say if you're like SaaS company, like true SaaS, where you're like B2B selling something, it's any type of like a lead gen campaign, they're all impacted in similar ways, just in terms of what can be tracked. Overall, it's just been sort of like system wide, and it's not just like online e-commerce, offline e-commerce as well. One of the great things and most amazing things about Facebook, because they know so much about all of the users, and they know, more or less hopefully potentially your true first and last name, but a pretty good idea of your city, pretty good idea of your zip code, state, etc. If somebody had a CRM, it's a feature that you can use, where you can basically upload offline CRM data into the platform, and they can match back offline purchases to online interactions. And that's something else that has been impacted by this, because if you have do not track, it applies across the board, not just online or offline. So not just what you would see from just the pure e-commerce ROAS, but also people who are optimizing for store visits or for actual offline transactions. That's been impacted as well too. So it's sort of a sort of watershed change.
Okay, that's interesting. So, I guess previously, if I'm understanding this correctly, I as a business website or whatever e-commerce retailer, I could upload my customer list to Facebook, and then Facebook would display relevant ads to those users based on their past purchase history from my database. Is that
Yep,
correct?
you could do it that way. So it could be you could upload that data and have it be something that you could target those people. So let's say I had a really segmented list of offline purchasers, where let's just say hypothetically, like I'm an appliance store or something like that, where 95% of my revenue is happening in store, where people prefer to come into the store to actually buy as opposed to buying it online, which is the way a lot of that business still operates. And if I had a list of people who, let's say, had purchased a washer and dryer from me, 3 years ago, and I've had an inkling that they might be interested in purchasing a refrigerator or something like that, you could upload a list of that offline data and say, like, hey, these are the people who had purchased washer and dryer. Let's serve refrigerator ads to them, or TV ads to them, or whatever that might be. So there was that from a targeting perspective. Perspective, but it was also from an attribution perspective, where if I had served an ad to somebody, and sort of the reverse mechanism, right? So instead of using it to target people, you kind of go the reverse lookup way and say, all right, these are the people who purchased from me this last week. I upload the data to Facebook. Facebook then translates the offline data to their online profiles based on what they know, and then they comb back through all of their ad logs and say, was this person served any ads from this advertiser? And if so, which ads? And which one should get the last credit for attribution? And they assign that. And then after you upload it within 24 hours, not only just the transactions, but also the revenue would show up in your ad platform. And that was a huge way to make decisions on, how I was, like, what did I spend and what was the true value of what I returned, not just for online. So that was also a huge change.
Is CAC going to go up, customer acquisition cost for, I guess, brands or, companies that are using paid?
Possibly. And this is sort of interesting. I was at a trade show a couple of years ago before COVID, and because of the way that all of these platforms, not just Facebook, but Facebook, Google, anyone who has a sort of like a smart bidding, they've gotten really good, as I was sort of alluding to earlier, at identifying the people who are likely to convert. And because it's all an auction system, people can bid what they want for these different, conversions. And so if you had multiple sort of, competing, let's say that's in market to buy a refrigerator or something like that, right? You have multiple appliance stores bidding on that data. what it's going to do is it's going to drive up the cost of those impressions, the cost of those ads. So we started to see, I think, sort of increasing cost per acquisition previously. And I think while it's gone up a little bit now, sort of having a little bit less of that race to the bottom is forcing brands to rethink strategy. And instead of relying so much on just bottom of the funnel, where you're literally duking it out with everybody else who's just sitting at the bottom of the funnel waiting, it's forced a change in strategy, which is, I think, fun to sort of learn about, like, how do we go back to the old school way of engaging people, you know, really, really thinking through the process of what are the types of messages I want to tell people who I, you know, would potentially want to convert. And I think there's a lot of value that can be found for advertisers by moving up the funnel. And while the platforms may not necessarily like it, because, you know, the increased costs in the auction have probably, well, definitely made all of them a lot of money over the past few years, they're still going to get, you know, money. It's just that it's going to change in terms of the number, you know, like their average CPM or yield per user on the platform side is changing. So I think it remains to be seen what the long-term play on that would be. If you're just sitting at the bottom of the funnel, yes. But if you have a strategy to sort of move up the funnel and do a great job of sort of engaging people and nurturing them eventually down to the point of conversion, I think that there's a big opportunity for brands there.
All right. So we can take some questions. If anybody in the audience has any questions or comments, love to hear it. Please just raise your hand. So the next question I have is the pandemic. And as I guess I call it is AP after pandemic versus BP, which is before pandemic. So shopping and retail, from, you know, your point of view, what the data that you see, how has that changed? I guess that can be as far as how companies are behaving and then how consumers are behaving.
So I'll start on the consumer side, because that sort of has direct relevance to the company side. Obviously, when everything shut down last March, in certain cases here in California, we were, I think, one of the first ones where it's like, you know, hey, essential only, right? Everybody was doing everything they could to find anything that they could get delivered online. E-commerce was the rage. Most people wanted absolutely nothing to do with going out and interacting with another human during the start of the pandemic. And I think that really helped a lot of companies. I think that, you know, the people who were set up and ready to deal with that, plus the businesses that were deemed essential businesses, reaped the rewards, whether right or wrong. The companies that were not set up to deal with that really got pummeled. And some of them are no longer here, unfortunately. And so, you know, if your business heavily relied on brick and mortar traffic and you weren't deemed essential and you had no mechanism for people to buy online from you, but somebody needed something, man, they're going to buy wherever they can buy. And so I think that in terms of the business perspective, it forced a really rapid transformation for folks who sink or swim to a degree. And some advertisers had, record years, just absolutely record years. And it's across verticals that you wouldn't necessarily think of, because, you know, people, a lot of it actually was probably home improvement, those types of things. People are spending a lot more time in their home. So, you know what, I'm not driving anymore. I have to commute to work. I'm eating in, I'm saving money. I'm going to reinvest that in my house. So like that flourished a ton. All the delivery type businesses, DoorDash, et cetera, that flourished a ton. I think, like, you know, your Airbnb, et cetera, those guys obviously flourished a ton. So it just kind of changed, you know, how consumers interacted. And, you know, I think if we're, you know, as we're sort of clawing our way out of the pandemic, I don't see a lot of that changing. I think it's sort of, you know, people have gotten used to the fact that, you know, I can get whatever I need delivered. And while there's a certain you know, obviously satisfaction going into a store and shopping. I think it's definitely changed how just how consumers are interacting. And you know, if we were an on-demand economy before, we are way much more an on-demand economy afterwards. And it's I think it'll give rise to sort of how people think about their business models now. You know, do I have that option for consumers, and you know, can consumers buy and interact with me any which way that they want, or am I going to sort of, you know, be limiting, you know, access to them by just sort of my business model?
Right, that's a good yeah, really good overview, thanks for that. So we have a good friend of mine up on the stage, Al Riza. Ali.
Hi, Ali.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, Dariush. Hi, Brian. I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Enjoying the beautiful weather.
Absolutely. First of all, I really, really want to thank you guys for your time, all the great insight and information. Wanted to get your thoughts on sort of like a different marketing strategy and possible return on investment, the ROI out of these two strategies, given the constraints that's being put that we've been, you guys have been discussing about how, you know, the first party cookies, third party cookies is making it harder to track. For some of the startups or recently established businesses that I've worked with, the challenge is the original sort of data that they have either on their existing customers or, you know, the people somehow they've had interactions with is very, very minimal. I really want to know your thoughts on the differentiation between an outbound approach or an inbound approach. Do you think it would make more sense to have more of an inbound approach, create specific content that would be in a sense deliverable to a bigger masses of audience that, you know, anybody would basically enjoy looking at, and then cultivate the leads through that funnel? What would be the possible ROI of this compared to trying to get whatever information that's currently available to narrow down and have more of an outbound approach and trying to get in front of the face of the person who's most likely to purchase from you? I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Great question, Ali. I think it depends on the business, and I think it depends on sort of like, you know, I guess what kind of numbers we're talking about scale-wise or your overall growth, and then also, you know, like what sort of resources that you have for content creation or to sort of, you know, that whole nurture cycle. I would say if you had to pick one or the other, depending on your sort of needs, I would probably say more of the inbound route that you were kind of describing of, you know, finding something that's going to resonate with as many people as possible and then slowly but surely segment and, nurture down different paths. Just that may have the best chance in sort of this new way of thinking about things to just get as much scale as possible at the lowest cost. But you know, there's also no reason you really can't do both. It might be a good way, you know, from what you have to try and supplement things, unless of course you're sort of resource constrained, to try and get as much data as possible so that you can, you know, sort of supplement supplement the sort of earlier strategy with the more direct strategy, because it depends on the time to convert, right? If you have sales goals and you know I need to have a certain amount of people or a model that says I'm a startup, I have to have this many subscribers or users or whatever it would be by a certain amount of time, you may need to sort of have a hybrid of the two, because it depends on sort of the time to convert. So hopefully that helps answer, but I would sort of lean towards the, you know, prospect wide and shallow, and then start going deeper where you start to get traction.
It makes a lot of sense. Appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, that's
thank you.
That's actually a really good point, Ali, because so as a business, I'm faced with this myself. We haven't really started actually on the paid side too much yet. We're starting on organic right now, but paid is something that I'm, you know, educating myself more and starting to plan. And one of my questions is that, I mean, really the balance between, you know, acquisition, you know, from a paid channel, and then optimization on our own app or our own website. And I think this is a question, is that are people actually paying more attention to optimization on their own properties as opposed to optimizing on acquisition and just traffic optimization?
Yes, 100%, because it's not, you know, I think what's, I've always sort of broken down online advertising into three sort of core principles, which is answering the questions of who do you want to reach, what do you want to tell those people, and then what do you want those people to do? And with all of the data, the middle part of the equation has potentially been, you know, like the creative messaging has possibly been overlooked, as has possibly like the on-site experience has possibly been overlooked too. So because people were able to just deliver such hyper-targeted ads that, you know, hey, I'm literally picking off all the low-hanging fruit. And so I think that it's forcing, you know, as we go up funnel, we also have to think about, you know, sort of creative messaging strategy and looking at what's resonating, you know, really with each audience. But then also what's the landing page experience. It used to be that, you know, that was a big deal where we would, you know, A/B test landing pages, converting pages. I think we're going to see a lot more of that in terms of, you know, what's the right content that people are landing on, and, you know, just putting ourselves back more into the, as marketers, back more into the consumer experience and trying to, you know, see it from the outside looking in, as opposed to just being sort of, you know, stuck with, hey, I'm doing whatever I can, and for no matter what I do, I just can't get a better return on my ad spend for this ad. Well, it's like, well, let's look at what we're seeing and look at the process of where we're landing people. And I think that's definitely going to come back into vogue.
Yeah, and one of my pet peeves that I don't see a lot of e-commerce companies, actually, especially smaller ones, pay attention is on enough investment into LTV optimization. I personally think LTV is the holy grail of the business.
Yep.
And, oh, yeah. You know, you have all these customers and people don't even have an account where people can log in and they can upsell them in the account. They just like leave all of that data, for example, on Shopify. And and Shopify, for example, I know doesn't have really a good manageable account yet. Maybe they're starting to work on it, but like understanding what people do on your site, not just before purchase but after purchase, is a gold mine that I'm hoping that more people actually pay attention to that.
Absolutely, and to add to that too, when you're thinking about like LTV, repeat purchase activity, and everything, a lot of times I think people will just immediately try and resell somebody, right? Okay, so you made an order. I'm going to wait exactly 30 days until I predict that your order is going to run out. I'm going to hit you up again to buy more of whatever it is I'm selling based on what it is that, you know, you purchased. And I'm not going to talk to you between now and those 30 days. But I think when you think about the concept of LTV and really driving LTV, you're missing out on a huge period of not necessarily trying to put an ad in front of somebody to get them to buy again, but that's a huge nurture period where, to your point, Darius, like looking to see what people are doing on site, trying to get an idea of how can I talk to them to, you know, especially if they're a brand new customer, it's their first purchase, you're in the testing out phase, right? What can you do to reinforce their opinion of your brand? And while they're thinking about possibly making another purchase during that time frame, that is a gold mine that so few people even A, think to explore, or B, effectively mine.
Yeah, I mean, so again, it's one of my pet peeves, and I love other people also spreading the word on that, because people are just focused too much on acquisition and then the pre-purchase optimization. Let's see, what we're coming up on time. What else of importance, in your opinion, did you find? I know that you guys did like a recent, was it a survey or a report that you published?
I'd be the bad employee here. I don't remember to call exactly the.
And I may be a bad interviewee and just throwing something into that that wasn't there, but so let's. I mean, believe me, I've got like I'm trying really hard to do the research before I get on the podcast, and I'm this is like my hobby, so I could definitely be the one at fault here. So. But so let's do this. Let's say, for example, what is like if I am maybe I'll give you my own case. So we have a company and we're doing something really new. And what this is that we our goal is to let consumers shop from local stores using live video.
Cool.
So we're building really like a discovery and a commerce destination that you can be anywhere in the US to begin. And you can go into our app and we'll tell you the stores that are around you and which ones actually can have people in the store that can actually sell you. So we do a different type of live shop selling, which is one-to-one and private, not like, you know, QVC or what a lot of other companies are doing, like TikTok, or where you have one person doing a show and 1,000 people watching. So we do private, higher price items, more considered purchases. And we are just getting started in Southern California, and we're going to expand out next year, you know, to other parts of the country. What, and I'm like literally talking to different companies, trying to put together a budget that I need to include in my fundraising process for growth on the digital acquisition, basically. What are some of the things that I should really pay attention and have in mind that might move the needle for us quicker with less cost?
First off, that sounds like a really cool business you guys have working on, so kudos to you for that. I would say the number one thing that I have found with really innovative breakthrough startups who are doing something that nobody's really doing before is I would invest really heavily in video in terms of telling your story and explaining to consumers how exactly everything works. I give this advice to, like, you know, our strategists and everything too, but it's like, if you can't describe it and say what you do in, you know, 5 seconds or less, you really need to invest in video. And I would say that, like, you know, looking at social channels, and, you know, YouTube, things like that would be the places that I would probably start in terms of like a paid media perspective. But, you know, building out the content on the site to explain sort of like exactly how it works and spelling out the value proposition to people, you know, something that's just brand new, it's, you know, your video is the way to let people know what it is you're doing and give them a sense of the experience without necessarily having to go through it. So I would say, you know, find a great creative agency who can help you tell your story. That can help you sort of like think through that process and, you know, evangelize to consumers, you know, what it's going to be like, you know, what the experience would be like. And then from there, start pushing that out. And something like that could, you know, especially through those platforms, through, you know, YouTube or through social, could kind of take on a life of its own by potentially going viral from, you know, paid media ads that could eventually sort of make their way that way. So, that would be my, you know, advice and sort of like a, you know, quick encapsulated conversation, would be to sort of really focus on the video and the experience there and, you know, just build in the cost, to the investors and say like, hey, look, this is what we think we're going to need to produce all this content. Once we have all of the different content, and I would build in a phase two for content, because whatever you learn from the first phase, then you can sort of, you know, iterate on that content and go a little bit deeper next time around and say, hey, this is you know, this content worked, this resonated, we need to kind of keep following this trend because this is generating a lot more interest than this other content. And you know, so an investment in the content would be key. And then from there, start smaller on the ad budgets. But I guess depending on sort of what your goals would be, but you know, in just Southern California, you don't have to have a massive ad budget, but you have to have the content that's going to convince the folks to pay attention.
Okay. Yeah, Ali, I'd love to hear your thoughts too.
No, thanks, Darish. Brian, I love that advice. I love the storytelling concept of it. My thoughts are actually sort of in the same direction. What I was thinking sort of in parallel to what Brian said, you might be able to invest a little bit into influencer marketing because I think you mentioned you're kind of looking for more of a high-end type of a clientele for luxury items. From personal experience, most of that category in terms of their behavior, they're very hard to convince to try something out for the first time. They, I think, mostly their emotional reaction to these things is, oh, I really need to know that this is tested out before I jump on board. So creating more of a social proof concept as the anchoring bias of your landing page or whatever other content you're creating, using influencers or having a lot of people that have already used this in terms of telling that story, I think that could have a good impact of convincing the person to be willing to try out your platform, and it's a path of least resistance for them to sign on and be on board with you. That's what came to my mind.
Yeah, totally agree, Ali. I would just say the caveat on that with influencers, make sure that you have local influencers, the people who are, or that have enough local following that are going to make it move the needle. But yeah, I totally agree. Like, I think that fits exactly in the line of, like, you know, something that's new. Nobody wants to be the first person sort of, you know, to try something. So, you know, if you see a popular influencer do it and they say how much they love it, then yeah, that can do wonders to launch a brand.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's what you both just said. Content. So content is really the foundation, right? Because you need that to do anything. And then, you know, I guess the influencers can actually help you create content, right?
Yep, exactly. If an influencer sort of like records themselves going through the process or talking about the process, a lot of brands that we've worked with have influencers that, you know, are a large part of their content creation, and it's authentic for the right influencers. So definitely helps.
So that's a really good point, because, like, you know, again, as far as like really getting to the next stage for us, that's literally one of the things I'm thinking about right now, is that how do we get like good videos that explain what we do? And I'm not like, I think what we need is like real human videos, because our solution is all about real humans. And we have some really good shopping agents. We also, we're all almost like, you can think about it like Postmates, but a lot more personalized. So we have some nice, really good talent that we can actually put in these videos. So I think I just actually had a meeting with influencer.co today that I missed. I got pulled into another meeting, so I'm trying to educate. So this is great. Well, I mean, all this tells me that I need really to ramp up finding a marketing whiz to come and join us. If you know of anybody who's looking or what might be interested, please let me know. We do need like a marketing I don't want to give a title, but almost like even at the co-founder level, I think this is like really critical for us. We've got the technology, our platform is ready, our software is ready. We actually have paying customers. We're starting to work with shopping centers. So what we're doing right now is that basically the concept of shop the mall, you can book an appointment with one of our agents at a mall close to you, and we'll walk you through any store that you want. Purchase any item you want and deliver it to you. So that's what. But I need somebody focused on marketing. So anyway, this is the beginning of my advertising for that.
There's I think you need to get a devil's advocate for your platform. That's for any startups, you really, really need somebody who's super tough on the idea. And if you can convince that one person as to why they should sign up on the platform, I think you can convince the easier users to be willing to try it out. You really need a devil's advocate at this point. Either it's a marketing person or, you know, you if you can play that role yourself, sort of have that sense of empathy toward that person, and that's how your video content and everything else comes up, I think that could be a great help.
That's a great idea.
That's a good, really good point. Yeah, I mean, definitely any startup person can easily be get drunk drinking their own magic tonic, so you always need somebody to ask you tough questions. So that's like one of the things that we are doing right now is user research, and this is end user research. So we are actually spending a good amount of like resources on signing up users to just go through the experience and tell us. And we're getting like really good feedback, but some of it is also tough feedback, which I love actually. So
that's awesome.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. So Brian, where are you located?
I'm up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. I'm in Orange County, and I think Ali is, so Ali has an agency also in San Diego, correct?
Yep.
Awesome. Nice. So we got the West Coast covered.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brian, for coming up and giving us all this useful information, and Ali for great questions.
I really appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jace, for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's been a pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Awesome. Well, have a great evening, and hopefully we'll hear more good news from everybody.
Sounds great.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.